Hi, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Dr. Sharif Moore of the Drug Free America Foundation. This is the Pathways to Prevention podcast, where we discuss some of the most innovative and inspiring work being done around the world in substance use prevention, treatment, and recovery. Joining us today is Dr. Kevin Sabet, a former advisor in the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy and the co-founder of Smart Approaches to Marijuana. Dr. Sabet's newest book, Smokescreen, available through Amazon on April 20th, 420, exposes the nexus of greed between the marijuana industry, politicians, big tobacco, and the pharmaceutical industry, where they are all poised to profit at great expense to the public health. Dr. Sabet, thank you for joining us, and thank you for writing this incredibly informative and eye-opening account.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
One of the quotes you mentioned in your book from The Economist that really hit me hard was, "While lab animals are an expensive way of understanding the risks of cannabis use, North Americans come free."
Yeah.
And that's what this really is, isn't it? Legalization. It's really a natural experiment that's being imposed upon us by the marijuana industry.
Yeah, and it's a really badly designed experiment because it's not really much informed consent. I don't think we're protecting the vulnerable, and I also don't think we're doing data collection well. So I'm giving it a lot of credit by using that word and wanting to use that word experiment. But yeah, I mean, that is what it is. It is a massive experiment in the loosest sense of that word. And I don't think we've thought through it. And when I, started to write this book, I thought I knew really everything there was to know about this industry, having studied it, profoundly for over 10 years and been in this field for now 25 years. I learned so much, and it wasn't pretty. And that's why I felt like the book needed to be written.
One of the other things you mentioned in the book is that the marijuana industry is borrowing a page directly from the tobacco industry playbook with their development of products that are designed to appeal especially to children, and so that they can presumably, they understand that that's where the market is. They're going to get their lifelong customer by hooking people when they're young, just as those leaked tobacco industry documents that you mentioned in your book revealed, which are really, really, sinister, especially, when they mention, how they understand the vulnerabilities of the young person's psyche and self-esteem and developing self-image. So it's kind of frightening to see the marijuana industry following down the same track.
Absolutely. Before legalization, we didn't have these kid-friendly products, these cookies, candies, sodas, the kinds of things that are attractive to really anyone under, say 25 or 21 for sure. And this is interesting because that's really a product of the industry. Drug dealers do really bad things, and kingpins like Pablo Escobar have done very, very bad things. But one thing they have not done is create these attractive products, mainly because that they didn't need to do that to sell what they were selling. But this industry that we've now legitimized, they're the ones responsible for these, 99% THC products that are out there and hooking kids. And I just think that's remarkable because we often think, well, it's a legitimate business. It'll care about public health and safety. But, a lot of these legitimate businesses, they really want, they all they want is profit. I mean, that's why you start a business. It's about profit. And so to me, this is addiction for profit. And the only way to maintain addiction for profit is to start people young, right? Because if they, I know this podcast is called Pathways to Prevention. We know the best way for prevention is of addiction is to make sure you don't start using before age 21, because you're then unlikely ever to use. And if you are going to use, you're very unlikely to become addicted to something without, some external extraneous circumstance that couldn't have been predicted. And so these companies know that. And so they want these products to be there to target young people. Even if you're not allowed to buy it when you're 15, you can get it from an older sibling or a friend. and it looks attractive. It's all over your Instagram. It's all over your TikTok in terms of advertising. So yeah, I mean, this is definitely something that's, I think, very, very, very concerning to me.
Yeah. And despite, you know, the supposed protections that are in place that are designed to keep it out of the hands of young people, we know these products are making their way into the hands of adolescents, as evinced by the skyrocketing rates of cannabis use disorder and problematic use among adolescents in Colorado and other states that have legalized.
Well, absolutely. And you're right on the money when you talk about the fact that we're dealing with problematic heavy use. So this isn't just, so there's a few dimensions that are really important. The level of THC is very important because the products that are being used are unlike anything we've seen before. I always say this isn't your Woodstock weed. This is much more harmful. It's genetically bred marijuana that's been bred to increase the THC. But on top of that, it's not that folks are occasionally using high potency THC, which would be bad enough. They're using it at rates we have never seen before. So the casual use rate, in other words, like once a year, once every 2 months, that's probably not even as high as it was in the 1970s when we had a lot of people using low-grade marijuana because that's all there was then. But the heavy use rate is at a much higher rate than it has ever been. We've seen a tripling, for example, among teens of daily use in the last couple of years. Numbers we've just never, we would not have predicted we are seeing with heavy use. And that amounts to many, many, many hours of intoxication. It's not just an hour of intoxication a year, and now it's gone from an hour to an hour and a half. No, it's an order of magnitude different. And I'm just very, very concerned about that. And that is, you know, we're sort of feeding right into the playbook of big marijuana.
And as you mentioned, the marijuana that was prevalent in the 1960s and 70s was much, much weaker, like 2 to 3% THC.
Yeah.
So today's marijuana, it's almost like it's a different drug entirely.
It is. Yeah, I said that exactly what you just said, that it is almost like it's a different drug completely. We've never seen levels like this. It's why, you know, even the New York Times columnist, Maureen Dowd, when Colorado legalized, she went there. She got one of these candy bars. She'd used marijuana before. She thought it would be fine. She used it, this candy bar, and she said she felt like she was going to die. She needed medical attention. I mean, this is somebody who went into it knowing it was going to be stronger. Imagine if you're just a person taking it up again you haven't used in 40 years, or you've never used because you're a young person, and you're now being exposed to this level. This is why we see, you know, over 400,000 emergency room admissions a year due to marijuana. And I think these numbers that, you know, I present in the book, because the book is both stories and numbers, actually. But the numbers, I think, would shock people.
Now, marijuana legalization is often cast as a social justice issue, but the data don't really bear that out, do they?
Not at all. I mean, if anything, it's social injustice. It's the name of one of my chapters, because for a couple of reasons. Number one, let's be honest about who's making money from legal marijuana. It's now legal in 16 states, 16 out of 50. The 16, who's making the money? They're not people coming from traditionally disenfranchised communities. I can tell you that. They're people that look like me, and they're making a lot of money. And it's a small number of those folks that are making a lot of money, but they are making a lot of money. Number two, the victimization of addiction is often to the most vulnerable people. So if you go and look at where liquor stores are in society or places to buy tobacco, they're not usually in the quote unquote good neighborhoods. They are most often in poor neighborhoods, along with a payday loan store, a church if you're lucky, and a little liquor store, tobacco, lottery, all of that. That's where the pot shops are going. Okay. So they're going to the places. And a lot of those places, by the way, they actually do not want them there, but they don't have the political power to keep them out, like the good folks in the suburbs do, you know? And so even though it's ironic because it's often actually whiter people who vote for legalization. On the other hand, whiter people don't, and people with money don't want it in their own community. So it's kind of like, yeah, I'm going to vote for it because it's fine and no big deal. But I have a kid now, so don't have a pot shop here. You should do it over there on the other side of town. That's a dynamic we've seen. And that doesn't help poorer communities. That's why, again, in the book, I talk about a couple of heroes of mine, James and Charmaine Hayes from Compton, who stood up to the marijuana industry with less than $500, and they stopped marijuana pot shops in their community, even though their state had overwhelmingly voted for legalization. So there is some of that pushback happening, and I highlight their story in hopes that it will be repeated. But unfortunately, more often than not, you have these poorer communities that are victimized.
And the other aspect too, I believe proponents have asserted that legalization would result in less people of color being arrested for marijuana related offenses. But hasn't the opposite actually happened in Colorado?
It has. In many states, it has, because they're also being arrested for public use. I mean, public use isn't legal in most places. And so they're being arrested for that. They're being arrested for some kind of marijuana related offense. You know, and they're being arrested disproportionately for all sorts of other things. I mean, so to say that this is some, you know, panacea to, you know, the injustice that we're experiencing, that many people are experiencing in the criminal justice system, I think is a fraud. You know, if this was happening the way it was promised, we should be seeing massive reductions in the correctional population in these states. We're not seeing that at all. If anything, in some of these states, they've gone up since legalization. I don't know if that's due to legalization or not. It could be. I don't know. I haven't seen those studies being done well. But the point is, we're not seeing these massive reductions. And we are seeing in certain groups, especially among youth, continued arrests and disproportionate arrests still as well. So this is certainly not helping in that regard either. I think it's been sold as a false pill to solve this issue, and it's not happening.
And it appears, according to the data that we're getting in from states like Colorado, that the costs associated with marijuana far outstrip any revenues, tax revenues from the sale.
Yeah, the revenue thing is so funny because basic math is forgotten when we bring up marijuana revenue. So the first basic math that's forgotten, first part of it, is the fact that this money being brought in is less than 1% of any state budget. It's a drop in the bucket. The other math that's forgotten is that in order to talk about a profit and whether something is benefiting, you have to count the costs. That's why it's called a cost-benefit analysis, is because you have the costs, right? That's also why it's called revenue versus profit, because revenue is only one side of the ledger. The other side is the cost. So I can't say I have a successful company just because I sold $1 million worth of t-shirts if it costs me $10 million to sell that $1 million. That's not a successful company. Nobody would want that company, even if it brought you $1 million in revenue, because the costs outweighed and it's weird that I even have to explain this. It's sort of like, didn't people take basic math? Like most people who are talking about this, they should have, but they don't. The logic just goes out of the window with marijuana. I mean, it's something about it. It just puts blinders on so many otherwise smart, well-intentioned people, actually. And I just think it's incredible that we haven't thought of that. And so, yeah, the costs have to do with things like drugged driving, which one person involved in a drug driving crash costs at least $1 million in total cost to society. Then you have, you know, the costs of people like with schools and citations and the things, you know, in Colorado, marijuana is now the number one reason why kids are cited at school. That costs money. That's time and money right there. There's workplace costs, workplace accidents and other costs, lost productivity as well. There are just a lot of costs that are not being quantified by a lot of people.
I believe another misconception among proponents, or at least people that use marijuana, is they think that the pharmaceutical companies are somehow funding the effort to keep marijuana from being legalized. But as you show in your book, the pharmaceutical industry, they're actually players in this, hoping to cash in.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, it's amazing. I'm still waiting by the mailbox for the big check from Big Pharma that's supposed to be coming for me because apparently I'm funded by Big Pharma. And yeah, we haven't ever take we don't take a penny from pharma and you know, or from any of these major corporations that are producing a lot of misery. If you, it's interesting, Fusion TV, which is a very you know, progressive television station, they didn't wanted to do an expose on us, you know, who's funding the movement to fight legalization. And I invite everyone to watch it. It's actually on our website. We love it so much because basically they said, oh yeah, no, we didn't find anything nefarious. If anything, we found a lot of money on the other on from the corporations and other things on the pro side. And it ended up being a pro side investigation rather than an investigation into us because they couldn't find anything. So it's just incredible. I guess, you know, I think genuinely some people are so in their pot world, they can't imagine why anybody would fund, you know, stopping it. But I think most of these folks that are accusing, they know they're wrong. They just, it's a way to distract. It's a way to not engage on the issue, frankly. And I'm ready to engage on the issue with anybody and anybody who disagrees. But, you know, when they start making these wild accusations, you know, it's incredible. I think one time, one accusation which made a major publication, which I just laughed at, is that we spoke for free. Sam did at an event. We had like a little mini rally at an event where a there were like 1,000 sponsors for prevention, and one of them might have been a pharma company. I wouldn't have chosen that, but they did. And somehow now all of a sudden we're in bed with pharma because one of 1,000 sponsors at an event we had a one-off 1 hour mini rally at was sponsored by that. So it's just that's how far they have to stretch.
One of the things that really piques my curiosity is you have some of these members of Congress, like, Chuck Schumer, that are just pushing this agenda so strongly. And it just makes me, question to what extent is he involved and does he stand to gain from legalization?
To be honest with you, maybe there's something where he's thinking I can gain money, but I really think, and I've talked with him, I've sat down with him at a few events actually. First of all, he always told me it was decriminalization, not legalization. And I always had to correct him that no, what you're introducing is not decriminalization, it's legalization. He still didn't get it. Let me tell you, the reason why like people like him, now I can't, that doesn't, this isn't for everybody, but for him, honestly, their younger staffers and their own kids, often in many cases, have convinced them that this is a great idea to get young votes and have convinced him on maybe the merits of it as well, without talking about any negatives. And that's why they're doing it. It's just incredible that that is literally why someone like Schumer is doing this because he never was in favor of it. You know, there are other senators like Cory Booker, Rand Paul on the right, who I think are true believers. Like we have a difference of opinion. But I honestly think of someone like a Chuck Schumer, he sees this as a political win among a segment of his base, and he's being pushed to do it by some of the young people around him.
Interesting.
I don't think he knows the details of anything that that they're talking about, to be honest with you.
Now, on the industry side of things, have you seen any evidence of, the Chinese being involved in funding legalization or trying to influence? Because you would think they would be interested in anything that would make us less competitive, which marijuana legalization certainly would.
Yeah, no, I do think that I haven't seen funding. I don't think I haven't seen that before, but I do know that I know they've actually registered some concerns about US legalization influencing their country. But frankly, if I'm a superpower competing, if I'm competing with a superpower and a superpower wants to do something that's going to make their population dumber, I'd probably cheer it along secretly.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
That they,
Yeah. Yeah.
wow. Well, can you talk a little bit about how COVID-19, the pandemic, has changed this whole dynamic of marijuana legalization?
It's a great, it's really, really, really a great question. So I've seen that First of all, a lot. I actually have a whole chapter in the book about COVID-19. There's been a lot of misinformation from the marijuana industry about how marijuana and CBD and different parts of marijuana are wonderful for COVID-19. And the issue is, you know, COVID-19 is in many ways a respiratory disease, and anything hurting your lungs and also making you less immune. I mean, marijuana, we know THC has major effects on the immune system. Anything like that is not advisable. And so, I just think that that's just an incredible thing to try and promote when we know that it's really not good for you. But the industry has taken advantage of it. Another way they've taken advantage of it is to have their stores be deemed essential, because they are saying, well, it's essential for people to get their medicine. And actually, it's essential for them to get any kind of marijuana for any reason. And we've seen most, but not all, governors and mayors acquiesce to that. And I've just been really disappointed with that, because, they just figure, well, let people get marijuana during the time where they're at home and they're bored and they're depressed and whatnot. I think we're going to see some big, big fallout from this.
And so they've even managed to jump on the telehealth bandwagon as well.
Oh yeah, they're jumping on the telehealth. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, look, they're very smart. I mean, this isn't the old 70s movement of, you know, some kids in a park smoking a joint. This is something that is very much very, very, very much part of a broader strategy.
So what can the average citizen do?
Well, the average citizen can learn more about this issue from the science, actually, do something where they get educated on what's happening. They can talk to everybody that they can about it, because people will be surprised. They'll say, well, I heard it's good for you. I heard it's no problem. We really need people to spread the word, especially among their circle and their elected officials.
Do you think that legalization at the federal level is inevitable?
You know, I was just asked that by somebody. I don't think it's happening anytime very soon. I think that it could be, introduced, but I don't see this happening tomorrow or even this year, probably not next year. There are a lot of Democrats that we've been in touch with in the Senate that are very concerned about this. I don't think they're ready to vote for it at all. They're concerned with the link to the opioid epidemic. They're concerned with big tobacco's involvement. You know, there's a huge trade group now on the Hill run by big tobacco that's trying to pass this. So I think they don't have nearly the votes yet.
So I see. So they're not, a single block when it comes to the marijuana issue.
I don't see it.
I just don't see how anybody could possibly think it would be a good idea to unleash another intoxicant, another addictive drug,
yeah,
on the American public when we're already in the midst of the worst substance use epidemic in our history.
It's just amazing. They don't see it as a drug. I think they see it as a plant. They see it as good for you. They don't see it as a drug. They see it as something totally different. And I think that that's a real, real problem.
You think that's the result of kind of clever messaging and marketing on the part of Normal and other groups like that?
Yeah, I do. I think that, this has been something for over 50 years that's been orchestrated. And then they got a cash infusion basically in the 1990s from a few billionaires. And that has catapulted them but it did take a while. I mean, it did. We had, majorly swung the other way in the 80s. Now they had a lot of momentum in the 70s. It swung the other way in the 80s. It kind of went back and forth in the 90s. And then since the 2000s, it's been going up with some ebbs and flow. But I think this is part of a much larger move. I actually think this is part of something a lot bigger than marijuana, frankly. We're seeing hallucinogens, psychedelics being legalized in places. We're seeing all drugs decriminalized, which doesn't mean that people just don't go to jail and they get help. It means that there's just absolutely no follow-up. There's no treatment being funded in Oregon where they decriminalized. It makes them ineligible for drug court. I think all of this is very purposeful.
And one of the players you mentioned behind this this broader push is George Soros and his Open Society Foundation. Well, one thing I've always wondered is, What exactly is his motivation? He's already got all the money in the world he could possibly need. I mean, what does he stand to gain from all of this?
I have been asked this so many times. And I think personally, I think that one of the reasons could be this issue of he has been convinced that the quote unquote war on drugs is similar to what you would have in a closed Soviet society, which is where he came from and where he was, feeling persecuted from in Hungary. And that this is something very similar to that. And he's been convinced by people like Ethan Nadelman, who was a Princeton professor talking about legalizing all drugs. And then Soros had lunch with him and said, why don't you leave Princeton and I'm going to fund a foundation for you. And that's what he did. And that's, what kind of began the ascendancy again of this movement. So, I think for others, it's money motivated. For others, it's more libertarian minded folks who ideologically think that you should be able to consume anything you want. So there are a lot of different motivations here.
So in a hypothetical situation, if you were the benevolent dictator of the United States, what would your solution be to the whole war on drugs and the substance use problem?
Well, I would invest a lot more in prevention. We don't invest nearly enough, and we need all kinds of prevention. There's all kinds of prevention that work. I would invest in treatment so that people can get treatment if they want it, but also I would invest in programs that motivate people to get treatment, because many people who are addicted, they don't want help. That's not what they want. And I don't believe this idea that you only will get help if you want it. Yes, that's ideal. Absolutely. That is ideal. But we've seen so many situations where people had to be cajoled in some way, like with a carrot and stick method, like drug courts. Or, I mean, look at, President Bush talked about how he quit drinking because he was threatened by, Laura, that she was going to leave him. That's what made him realize he needed to change. It wasn't that, there was treatment. He could go to treatment. He had a lot of money. He could always go to treatment. That wasn't an issue for him. So, addiction is complex. It's a complex biobehavioral disorder, and it responds to both sort of biological, pharmacological remedies, which we know that are out there that help, but it also responds to behavioral interventions and things that make you really think about something. And that can change even this brain disease. It's different than something like, hypertension or asthma in that way. And I know that in many ways in the addiction field, we want to be treated like hypertension and asthma. Like this is like going to the doctor and having, hypertension, but actually, there's parts of it that are similar, but I think there are parts of it that are also very different.
Yeah. And it leaves me wondering, this focus on treating the disease, who is asking, why are people using drugs in the first place? Why as a nation we have this, where so many people prefer to numb themselves than to face life on life's terms.
Exactly. Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Kevin Sabet.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. I think you're doing great work, and I want to continue to keep going and urge you to keep going, and we got to get the word out. And I really appreciate the support.
Okay. Thank you. And best of luck to all your future endeavors and with your new book.
Thanks, Sharif. Appreciate it.